It is time for the single coolest sports show in the country, The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics.
You've got Matt Bonner, who my notes tell me is a sandwich blogger named Red Mamba. I mean, how can you not like a guy like that?
And the Red Rocket knocks down the triple.
Red Rocket, I'm telling you, Red Mamba might not miss a shot.
Just like in politics, in the instructional video business, you need credibility.
You want credibility? I'll give you credibility. Hey, Tim, what's my nickname?
The Red Rocket.
No.
The Sandwich Hunter.
No. Fry Gun.
The Medium Fundamental.
And welcome to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire. Matt, still down in Texas. He's doing some work for the WNBA affiliate down there, the San Antonio Stars. Am I correct? Stars? Is that right?
You are correct.
Yeah. All right, first big win of the show today. And he's doing some color art for them on their TV broadcast. So still in Texas. We'll be headed back up to the great state of New Hampshire shortly, I am sure, particularly since the Bonner basketball camp is coming up the last week in June here in the city of Concord. We'll talk some NBA and some other stuff, as always, on the show. Looking forward to talking to Johnny Gomes in the middle segment of the program. Actually, that already happened, so I look forward to have already spoken with him. And also coming up in the middle segment of the program, an interview with Kyle Busch as well. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am great. Appreciate you joining us for the show. And so, Matt, we didn't talk last week, but I can predict how our predictions would have been for the NBA Finals if, in fact, we had. I'm sure that you would have picked the Golden State Warriors, and as I did, I would have picked the Cleveland Cavaliers. And you've been strong on the West Coast bias, and I thought a little bit too much. I thought that the teams were actually pretty even, and I watched them, you know, completely destroy the Celtics for the overwhelming majority of the Eastern Conference Finals, the Cavaliers, that is. So, I went into this believing in the Cavs, and so far I have been completely wrong in this series. And I think that one of the big reasons for that has been, you know, the star power of the Golden State Warriors. They have been cohesive. They have been great. They have defended. Their role players have been good enough. And for Cleveland, you know, their stars haven't been as good. And, you know, you look at the role players for them in game two, and Kyle Korver, Tristan Thompson, you know, 8 points. That's the most for the role players. J.R. Smith didn't score at all. And, you know, as a result, two blowout victories for the Warriors to begin the finals.
I wouldn't jump to conclusions just yet. The Warriors defended home court. We'll find out more in games three and four when the series shifts back to Cleveland. However, you're right, it doesn't look good for the Cavs faithful. And, you know, it seems like Golden State has so much firepower that the only chance to me that Cleveland has, they don't need just one kind of role player X factor to go off. They need like two of them. Mm-hmm. They need like Korver to have a 6-for-8 night from the 3-point line, mm-hmm. and J.R. Smith to score 20, and their stars to play well. Because it seems like you can't guard Golden State. I made the comment via my Twitter that after game one, the observation was Golden State scored 113 points, and Klay Thompson and Draymond Green were combined 6-for-28. Mm-hmm. They still scored 113 points. So my thing was, going into game two, this could get scary, and it did. They scored 132 points, and that was with pulling their starters for the last 4 minutes of the game. So I think you can defend them and maybe slow them down a little bit. And this is going to sound crazy, but I think good defense would hold them in, like, the 110s.
Yeah.
Like any other game, that would be, like, horrible. You gave up 115 points.
Yeah. But they play so fast.
Hold them, like, yeah, I think if you can hold them in the 110s, and then if you're Cleveland, your stars play well, like they've been playing pretty well, but then you get a couple X factors, make shots and have big games, maybe you can outscore them and get a W.
Right, and you know, one of the big reasons, same thing with the Celtics, of course, during the course of this year, that they score so many points is because they're quick into their sets, and they take quick shots. They get quick makes
a lot
of the time.
They shoot a lot of threes.
Yeah. They shoot a lot of threes. And it's not like your traditional.
It's not just the pace. They're
good.
So many weapons.
Very good.
They have two MVPs in their prime on the team. That and they're their ability to go on runs fast is scary. You might think, you know, you might be able, like Cleveland in game two, you hang with them for two and a half quarters, and you think you're right there, and you're going to give yourself a chance to win down the stretch. And then, bam, in like a two-minute span, you're down 18. Like, it just happens so quick with the way the Warriors play, with their pace that you mentioned, combined with all their offensive weapons and how many threes they shoot. It's just a scary prospect.
The scary thing, too, if you're from a Celtics perspective, is you watch the NBA Finals, and you know it feels a lot like, not as dominant as the Celtics, you know, Cavaliers series, but it feels a lot like that, where you're watching, you know, a team that you just can't beat. Like, you can get close, but too many stars, too many superstars. They're going to make plays, and they have to, you know, 15-0, 18-0 runs within the snap of a finger. And, you know, as the Celtics plan things out, you know, you have to think about where the Warriors are right now. And, you know, granted, there could be some changes in future years based upon how many superstars they have, their ability to pay, and so forth. But, you know, you just got off of the Eastern Conference Finals, and you saw how far behind the Cavs you were. And now you're going into, you know, you're looking at this series and how far ahead the Golden State Warriors are of the Cavaliers. And, you know, I wonder how that alters the thinking of Danny Ainge going into the offseason. I mean, to me, you just have to make the best decisions you can at this point in time to put the best team on the court that you can. You can't worry about, you know, how am I going to come up with stars to match up with Kevin Durant and Steph Curry, yeah, because they're just not out there. But it's got to be pretty, you know, not just Danny Ainge, but it's got to be pretty dissuading for every other GM in the league right now to see, you know, how these teams are. And it's been, you know, over a long period of time now, starting with the Celtics in 2007-08. These super teams are extremely difficult, you know, to compete with. So do you build a really good team with the best options that are available, or do you just see what happens, knowing that you're probably not going to win unless you have, you know, one of these super teams, one of these teams that has two MVP caliber players and another superstar and role players to fill the gaps. And, you know, really outside of your team, that's been the teams, you know, that have won for the last 10 years.
I mean, I think you have to build the best team you can. I don't think you build a team trying to match up with the Warriors. You got to try to build overall the best team you can and try to build a better team than the Warriors have. And then, you know, the other side of it is you have to have luck come into play. You know, the Warriors are healthy this year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, Curry's knee was bugging him. Draymond Green got suspended, mm-hmm, game three. So that kind of played into the Cavs' hand. You got to wonder if Curry's 100%, Draymond Green doesn't get suspended, do they blow a 3-1 series lead? Probably not. And then you're talking about a three-peat. So that's part of it. Secondly, I don't think you can build a team to match up with the Warriors, and this is what makes the Warriors special, in my opinion, is that two of their players, their two MVP guys, Steph Curry and Kevin Durant, there's nothing you can do to keep them from getting their shots off.
Mm-hmm.
It's just if they're going to have an off shooting night or not, and they're such great players and such great scorers and shooters, chances are they're not. Obviously, Durant, being 7 feet tall with his 7-whatever wingspan, he's going to get his shot off no matter what. And then Curry, with his ball handling, quick feet, and crazy quick release, he's going to find a way to get his shots off. And that also goes to the point, I don't know if you've been seeing, there's a lot of former players been saying, you know, guys, teams just don't play hard enough. They don't want it enough. They don't play hard enough. Otherwise,
that's crazy.
Nothing about a super team.
Yeah.
If you played hard enough, you could beat the Warriors. And I don't think that's true, because you can play like the Tasmanian devil out there, but you're still not going to be able to prevent Kevin Durant from shooting whatever shot he wants to shoot because of his size and skill level. And same with Steph Curry. They're going to get those shots no matter how hard you play. They're smart. They have a gifted skill set to be able to do that. So I don't think you just counter it by playing harder. That's a ridiculous argument to me.
It is, so, because I think we're watching teams that are, I mean, teams that are playing hard in this postseason. I don't think that you can say the Celtics didn't play hard. I don't think you can say the Cavaliers didn't play hard against the Celtics. The Cavaliers' defense against the Celtics, particularly in those first two games and into game five, was, was remarkable.
I thought in game two of the finals, the Cavs played so hard.
Yeah.
They played so hard, especially in that first quarter. You know, they came out on all cylinders going all out, and the Warriors still scored 40 points.
Yep.
And they scored 40 points with a bunch of turnovers on top of it. They're lucky they'd score 50 points in a quarter. It's really a remarkable team the Warriors have on offense, and their chemistry and their pace. If they can keep that group together and stay healthy, I don't know. It's going to be tough to knock them off their pedestal. Moving forward after this year.
To me, either of these two teams in the finals would destroy the teams of the 80s and the 90s. I truly believe that. And, you know, granted the fact that we could make, you know, it's always difficult with these arguments because you could say, well, they're in superior condition, there's different conditioning, you know, they don't, the training is much better, obviously, now than it was. And you could, you know, if you want to draw, you know, some equality in the argument in that way, and then perhaps, you know, those teams are closer. But as it is right now, people are saying that, you know, the teams in the 80s were better and the beautiful game and those guys played hard, and these guys would destroy Larry Bird's Celtics.
Think about the 80s. Do you ever remember players in the finals hitting like 6-7 threes in a game?
No, or hitting the type of contested shots that these guys hit.
Maybe it's like if you hit 3 threes, it was like the front page headline the next day. Now, like, making 3 threes in a finals game is like nothing. It's a different game.
It's complete.
So much versatility on the court for both teams. Those traditional 80s teams, I'm not sure how they could match up with the versatility of these rosters.
And the depth of the rosters, too. I mean, that's the same thing. I mean, you know, versatility, depth, I mean, the Celtics 80s teams had, not a lot of really good players coming off the bench. There was not, you know, the incredible depth that these teams have where, you know, you have guys who are sitting who have a role to play and can come in and be, very effective players. And, you know, perhaps the fundamentals of the game were better back then, quote unquote. But even still, I mean, I think that the game was in a place, you know, in 2000, when you first broke into the league, where it was ugly, ISO, stagnated basketball. But now I see a combination of players playing the quote-unquote beautiful game that I think the Spurs really brought back into things with their success. You look at some of the passes that LeBron makes and some of the passes that Steph Curry makes. I mean, these guys can distribute the basketball and play that type of beautiful game as well, but they're also athletic specimens that can get shots off in very tight range and also make plays to the basket that, you know, even the greats of all time, from Oscar Robertson to Bob Cousy to Magic Johnson, all great players, but playing against the type of high-end caliber athlete that is playing in the game right now, I just don't see how they could, you know, compete. And I really can't say that these guys aren't playing as hard as, you know, the 90s and the 80s. To me, that's old guys, you know, romanticizing and thinking about things and trying to say it was better back in their day. And it's just not the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like anything in human culture, progress.
Yeah.
Things are constantly getting bigger, better, faster. And I think sports is the same thing.
And sometimes sometimes it stalls, and sometimes there's those periods of difficulty where, you know, the game isn't as good. As I mentioned, I think that, when the Nets were going to the finals against the Lakers and Allen Iverson's Sixers were in the mix, I don't think the league was all that good then. I think that the league kind of hit a stalemate at that point after Michael Jordan. But since then, I've seen just tremendous progress in the league, again, combining some of the changes that you're mentioning with the basketball that we saw back in the you know, the 80s. And that's why the game is at its pinnacle right now. The unfortunate part is that, you know, there are, as I mentioned, you know, these super teams. There's not a lot of parity, which is good and bad. And that the games just have not been all that good during the course of this postseason. And that we are in the NBA Finals and we're, you know, looking right now at the Cavs looking to find something going home. I mean, that's not necessarily all that good for the league, despite the fact that, as I've mentioned, the caliber of basketball is as good as it's ever been.
Well, it's good for the Warriors.
Yeah.
It's good if you're a Warriors fan.
All right, it's the life of Matt Bonner.
Yeah, that's about it. I agree with you.
It's the life of Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. We'll talk about that. And, you know, parity in the game versus dominant teams, because the NBA always seems to have, you know, dominant teams. You look at baseball right now, and baseball's struggling with identity. They're struggling to have guys who are well-known and to reach the common fan. The NFL, there's a lot of parity in that league as well, despite the fact the Patriots have been really good, and the NHL as well, where the NBA is, in my view, the healthiest of all the professional sports in regards to economics because of their outreach across the globe, but has the least parity. So is parity a good thing or a bad thing? We'll talk about that. In the middle segment of the program, we'll talk with Kyle Busch. He was at New Hampshire Motor Speedway. Of course, the Speedway has lost one of their two races in 2018. We'll talk to him about that. Also, interviews with Wade Boggs and Phil Negro from Cooperstown. And Johnny Gomes talks about being a former baseball player in kind of the same realm as Matt, where, you know, as we've talked about before, a lot of guys get to, you know, get to do their farewells, like Paul Pierce and David Ortiz. And for a lot of individuals, as Goose Gossage once said, you don't leave the game leaves you. And Johnny's one of those guys. We'll talk with him about how he's coping after this. Welcome back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire. Matt in San Antonio will rejoin us in just a little bit. This segment of the show is powered by Revision Energy. For the past 9 years, that their team of local solar professionals has been putting sunshine to work for thousands of Granite State families and businesses looking to save money and help save the planet for our kids. Visit revisionenergy.com to schedule a free consultation. That's revisionenergy.com. What can sunshine do for you? Well, so far, the Golden State Warriors have dominated the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals. If you had to pick a Finals MVP for the first two games, it would be Kevin Durant. But he is warning his teammates, fans, and everybody who will listen that the Warriors cannot be complacent, being up two games to none. They need to continue to take the fight to the Cavaliers as the series shifts to Cleveland.
We're just trying to stay with it. We know this is far from over. We know how hard it is to, you know, be the best team in the league. So, we got to just put, you know, keep going, man. Keep our foot on the gas and keep getting better every day.
None of the Red Sox have been playing much better as of late. Boston in their last contest defeated the Baltimore Orioles 7-3 to earn a split in Baltimore. Boston now a game and a half ahead of the Orioles for second place and 1.5 games to the good in the wild card standings, while trailing the Yankees by two games in the American League East. That is where they head next. Andrew Benintendi keyed the Red Sox offense as they cruise past the Orioles 7-3 in Baltimore. Benintendi finished with a team-high 3 hits, including 2 home runs and 3 RBI. He says having a guy like Chris Sale on the hill takes a lot of pressure off of the offense.
When you got Chris on the mound, you know, if you score 3 or 4 runs, I mean, you have a good shot of winning. So, you know, when they came back with that 3, and maybe there were some mishaps there in that inning. So, you know, after that, we just, you know, refocused and got back after it.
Speaking of Andrew Benintendi, I wanted to talk to Wade Boggs, who was at the Baseball Hall of Fame for the Hall of Fame Classic game, which took place a couple weekends ago, about Benintendi and also about hitting in general. But to me, the most interesting thing is seeing, you know, all these legends, these baseball gods from different eras coming together in order to have conversations, discussions. And it's always one of the more fascinating parts of seeing, you know, Goose Gossage with Wade Boggs, or seeing Ozzie Smith with Juan Marichal. Guys didn't necessarily play against each other, but have this commonality with the Hall of Fame. Here's my conversation with Wade Boggs.
Boggsy, what's the Hall of Fame like in terms of the conversations that exist between the players? You guys talk baseball? Do you talk about families? What is it like, that group that you're in, and the conversations that exist amongst guys who are, you know, basically the gods of baseball?
Well, we talk about baseball. We talk about the game today and discuss various things and catch up on what happened in the past year since we haven't seen each other or bumped into them along the way.
What do people ask you the most about in regards to hitting, and what advice do you give them about how you go about hitting, to the type of consistency that you have?
Probably the big thing about that I try to I coach high school baseball in Tampa is to get to the kids that they're comfortable taking pitches and working the count into a situation to where they have an opportunity to get a good pitch to hit, and that's what we preach.
Does it seem like the mindset is different in regards to that today than when you played? Was there you know, a different mindset in regards to being comfortable taking pitches?
Yeah, when I watch baseball today, the kids get in the box and swing at the first pitch, and there's not a lot of patience. Guys don't walk a lot. It's fashionable to strike out. A lot of guys swing up. But it's a whole different generation. And now with all the shifts and everything that they have going on, you just kind of wonder why the guy can't hit a line drive the other way.
Have you gotten to watch Benintendi a lot with the Red Sox, and what do you think of his stroke?
Not too much. I haven't seen a lot of him. Looks like a fine young hitter. He's got a good swing. The big thing about anything is time will tell, you know, how he gets more comfortable as time goes by.
Well, Scott, the opportunity to catch up with my old friend Johnny Gomes, the 2013 World Series championship team, as he was in Cooperstown playing in the Hall of Fame Classic.
Always great to see Johnny Gomes this time in Cooperstown, taking part in the Cooperstown Classic. And to me, I mean, this has to be something that means a ton to you, the way that you love the game, the way that you breathe the game. Get the opportunity to be here, play in this, and come and visit Cooperstown.
Yeah, I got asked, you know, to represent the A's and come out here. And it was a no-brainer for me, considering this being on my bucket list. I mean, real high for something to check off. Not only Doubleday Field where we are right now, but, you know, the whole museum. The only thing I had thrown in, you know, to this trip was I need, like, the full VIP up and down tour of the museum. Something I'm a huge fan of, obviously, the history of the game, everything that goes on there. So I can't wait for that to happen.
I remember when you hit the home run in Game 4 in St. Louis, and one of the things you were most excited about was the fact that your bat and I believe your cleats were going to to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like a iffy deal when they asked, you know. They're like, you know, can we take your bat, and we got to take it now. And, I mean, it was just an absolute no-brainer, you know, for me. I brought my son on this trip and my father-in-law, so the opportunity to walk into the Hall of Fame and have, you know, something of mine there. Selfishly, but then on the other side, you know, the history that we made with the Red Sox, and get to check on our Kansas City stuff as well. And then, you know, I'm wearing the A stuff right now, you know, the team I grew up watching, you know, everyone from Ricky Henderson to the three-time championship in the 70s, and I mean, on and on. My son's favorite player is Babe Ruth, and pretty much got to come here to see some of his stuff. So all in all, awesome.
One of the things that stands out most about baseball players, they hit the point in their careers where you're at, is a statement from Goose Gossage where he said, baseball is a game that you don't leave, the game leaves you.
Yeah.
And you're kind of at that stage where you obviously would still like to play and still like the opportunity, but it's just one of those things that you can't find that opportunity. What's that like for a guy, particularly like you?
I mean, I was okay with it, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think, you know, the guys that are chasing the 10 years, you know, 7, 8, 9 years, trying to chase that one. On the other side, trying to chase that championship, you know, almost like chasing a ghost with both those. So fortunate to walk away with this game with 10-plus. So fortunate to walk away with this game for a ring for each hand. Playoffs 6 times, got banners hung in 6 different ballparks. So that made the decision easier, I guess, if you will, because I accomplished, you know, everything I wanted to, and, you know, all I want to accomplish was, you know, team wins. So with that being said, I can lay my head down at night and, you know, pass the torch.
What are you thinking about in terms of post-career? Because I always saw you as a, you know, potential coach-type guy, because you live and breathe the game. You understand the fundamentals, which allowed for you to have the success you've had, particularly in regards to hitting. And it was fun watching you teach the kids how to hit. And you said, you know, you want to play third base, you want to play outfield, here's what you got to do. You got to hit.
Yep, you got to hit. I mean, you know, our game is results driven, you know, and the results that really count, you know, are runs. And, you know, you can't score runs pitching, but you need that too. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, I'm a baseball lifer, baseball junkie. You know, my time in the batter's box is obviously done, but really enjoy, you know, grooming guys and helping guys out, because I'm extremely biased to the guys that helped me out come. And, you know, I would have been nowhere without, you know, the vets around me and the coaches around me. So thankful for them. And When the time will come, you know, I'll strap him back on in the coach's box, absolutely.
Do you see in, you mentioned the young guys coming up, did you see in Xander and, you know, Mookie, you were with him a little bit, Jackie as well came up in 13 and 14. Did you see the future that those guys have, you know, projected into actuality now?
I did, you know, tell you the truth. I think one of the first things that you can do is when you look at a kid, I think what you have to, you know, picture in your head is who does he look like? Mm-hmm. You know, not physically, but who does his swing look like? Who does he run like? And every once in a while, you'll see this kid coming up that hits like no one, you know, throws like no one, but it's good. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a red flag in my eye. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of is. You know, I looked at Bogarts, and he hit this ball into left center, his first career home run, and I watched him run around the bases, and I was like, that's A-Rod, mm-hmm. you know, the tall guy. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going to hit 600 home runs. I'd love for him to prove me wrong, but, you know, I saw it. And then, you know, with Mookie Betts, I'll tell you the truth, I saw McCutcheon. You know, mm-hmm. I saw his hands kind of low, mm-hmm. you know, with the knee kick and the thing and the great eye. So, you know, once they cross that off, that they're not, you know, going to uncharted territories, I think you'll see success. And, boy, they're having it.
The final thing, we've talked about this before, and to me, you know, we sit here 4 years out from that amazing – you know, championship, a championship that a lot of people in Boston just didn't see coming. That team was a lot like this Celtics team, except you guys, you know, finished off the deal where nobody just expected it to, you know, to happen, and it was a special, unexpected championship that year. And, you know, you look around the clubhouse, there's not a lot of guys there from that team left. Mm-hmm. Are you surprised about how things, you know, ended for that group? Did you expect more success after 13 and in 14 into 15 and things were going to kind of roll from there?
Yeah, I mean, now you're getting into, you know, the suit and tie deal of it, which, you know, I'm not good at. But, I mean, you look at that team right now, you know, Dustin Pedroia, I think, is the only one on that roster that was on that World Series team. And it wasn't too long ago, but, you know, if there's a guy to continue the torch, it would be him. So, you know, with that being said, there's guys still playing, and, you know, the Cubs guys just hung another banner. So, but, you know, can't take that ring away, and that's what's awesome.
Johnny Gomes right there. Kyle Busch at the Hampshire Motor Speedway last week to do some testing ahead of July's big race. And topic of conversation, of course, the fact that New Hampshire Motor Speedway losing one of their two races in the 2018 season.
Kyle, you've obviously had an interesting relationship with New Hampshire Motor Speedway over the years, and was interested in your initial reaction when you heard that the track was losing a race beginning the 2018 season.
I mean, I've always enjoyed coming to New Hampshire. It's been a fun place. I've run well here. I've run well at places that are kind of like this. And it's a fun area, too. You know, I ran the Oxford 250 a few times and stuff like that. So the fans up here, they certainly enjoy their racing. But, you know, for the race to be moved from here to go to Las Vegas, I'm kind of partial to that, too, being a hometown boy from Las Vegas. So, you know, I'm excited about the opportunity to go to Vegas. What I'm not excited about is a second race at another venue that we were already at. You know, I'd much rather see some of these second dates at places. If you're going to lose a date, go to a new track or to revive another track or something in that nature. So, you know, it's going to be a part of the chase, though, and it's going to be in Vegas. It's going to be the only track on the circuit that's going to have two triple-header weekends. So for all that, it's going to be good for Vegas.
Are you concerned in regards to, you know, the business side of things and how the losing of a race is going to, you know, affect NASCAR here and so forth?
Yeah, I don't think there should be reason for concern. I think that this place puts on enough of a show and a good enough show that as long as people continue to come and support the racetrack and the racing that they see up here, that then, you know, they'll keep that date that they have. Probably forever, but you know, if taking a date away makes people angry and they don't show up, they're going to lose the second date. So you got to be careful.
How do you see yourself having evolved as a driver over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years and gotten better, more mature, so to speak?
I don't know. You know, the thing about it being a race car driver is that the race cars change so much that you have to adapt to what the race cars are changing to. So I feel like that's been one of my strong suits since the beginning when I used to race back at my hometown with racing Legends cars and late models and modifieds and dirt and pavement and road course racing, stuff like that. Is I always did so much in order to make sure that I was getting everything that I could get out of learning. And I think that's kind of the same thing that you have now with me running in trucks and Xfinity and Cup, is you continue to kind of see how all these things evolve and how the cars and the equipment evolves. and to make sure yourself is up on top of your game.
How much of the changes and kind of constantly having to evolve help you as a driver? In other words, if everything was kind of, you know, consistent and everything was the same, you know, would there be kind of a boring aspect to it as opposed to having to constantly evolve and have variables?
I wouldn't say you were bored, but I think that, you know, with constant or consistency in our sport, you know, I don't know. I don't think that's ever existed. You know, even in late model racing back in the 70s and 80s and 90s into what it is today, like, it's always evolved, and you always see different characters and different drivers and different people become successful. You know, it was Dick Trickles and Senekers and Mike Rose, and now you've got younger guys that are making their way up through there, and the cars are entirely different, so, you know, you're seeing different people win races all the time.
This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics, that segment of the show presented by Revision Energy. Welcome back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire. This segment of the show presented by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. So, Matt, is parity good or bad? Because, you know, in the NBA, there's never really been parity, and it is one of the more frustrating sports when you're a fan and your team just can't get over the top. And as I've talked about before, I grew up a huge Knicks fan in New York, and, you know, for whatever reason, actually, I know what reason it was, they weren't as good. They could never get past the Chicago Bulls, except one year when, yeah, 94, when Michael Jordan decided he's going to play baseball for whatever reason. And they got a benefit of a call where Hubert Davis was fouled and went to the line, was able to get the Celtics, you know, a win in a series that they should have won, but had to get a little help from the officiating in order to do so. But each year, you know, the Knicks ran into a team that was better than them, and, you know, I think that that's one of the interesting parts about basketball, is that there's always, you know, two or three teams in the league which are clearly better than everyone else, and everyone's just kind of, you know, chasing them, looking for that moment when they can, you know, achieve equality and then kind of get past them. A great, you know, example, of course, is the Detroit Pistons in the late 80s trying to get past the Celtics. Couldn't do it in 87, and then were finally able to do it in 88, and then they won their championships after that. So is parity a good thing for the NBA? Do they need to have parity, or is everything working the way that it should in the league?
Well, first of all, I don't think parity hasn't existed. Obviously, you look at the last couple of years, you could argue there isn't as much parity as there was in the past. But for most of my time on the Spurs, we weren't always the one seed, but we always, going into the playoffs, believed and actually legitimately had a chance to win a championship. Mm-hmm. Whether we were a 6 seed or a 2 seed or the 1 seed, that didn't really matter. It's really in more recent years with the Warriors and the Cavs creating those what you call super teams, and especially this year with an already super team adding Kevin Durant, creating a super duper team, if you will, where I think the parity has disappeared a little bit. And then, you know, they asked Kevin Durant about that, and I agree with his comment. You know, it's not his fault that Orlando isn't winning, or New York's not winning, or New Jersey's not winning. You know, he doesn't play for them. And I agree with that. That's organizational issue based on each NBA organization. You know, it starts with management and coaching and trickles down to who you bring on your team, how you develop your players, et cetera. And, you know, how you tweak that via free agency rules or draft, how you do the draft in order to try to give teams that are having trouble winning some type of advantage or some edge to become more competitive. You know, we could argue about that all day, mm-hmm. but I agree with Kevin Durant. Him going to the Warriors isn't the reason why Brooklyn came in last in the league or whatever. You know what I mean? And then the other double-edged sword to me with parity or lack of parity is it's a superstar-driven league, and when you have these dominant teams, it really bolsters the profile of the stars of those teams. It really creates superstars in the true sense of the word. you look at the big three on Cleveland, you look at the guys on Golden State, Durant, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, Steph Curry, they get that much more coverage, that much more excitement around their names. And in that regard, it is good for the league, I think. But, you know, in a perfect world, every team finishes 500, and who knows what's going to happen in the playoffs. That's probably more entertaining, but just not how it works.
And I think that baseball is the perfect, you know, counter-argument, where baseball right now, you have just that, where you have a lot of teams that are around 500. There are not a lot of superstars in the game because there's not a lot of super teams in the game. And baseball is struggling with that name-brand recognition of its stars. Even guys you think would be big stars nationally, like Mike Trout and Bryce Harper. There's recently a list of, you know, the top 30 most famous athletes in America, and there wasn't a single baseball player on that list. And you know, baseball right now has too much parity, where you think a lot of times the teams that you're watching, you know, aren't good enough. And the NFL for the same thing. I mean, I don't think, as we talked about before, anybody can question how good the Warriors and the Cavaliers are in the history of the game. I mean, we could certainly make the argument, in my view, that the Golden State Warriors team this year is, you know, potentially the greatest team ever, and we'll see what they do, you know, in this series, based upon the type of MVP caliber players that are on their team at that point in time, playing like MVP caliber players. And
yeah, and not to cut you off, Chris, but it also creates excitement in knocking out, you know, the whole David versus Goliath.
Sure,
the underdog. It just, I mean, who would think the Cavs, people are rallying around the Cavs. Like, if you're just a common fan who doesn't live in Cleveland or the Bay Area, you're probably rooting for the Cavs because people tend to root for underdogs, right? So it creates excitement like that. Like, I remember when the Heat had their super team with LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, everybody was rooting for the Spurs. Both times we were in the finals to knock off the Heatles and, you know, all their perceived super
arrogance.
Team, and we were the underdog, yeah, and arrogance, whatever, whether it existed or not, that's just how they're perceived,
right?
Because they have that super team. And in that regard, it creates excitement as well.
You're absolutely right, and I think that was one of the great things about, you know, why people love the Spurs, and the Spurs were kind of the ultimate underdog in that role, and I think that people, you know, truly, truly like that. And yeah, the frustrating part a lot is usually, you know, if David and Goliath doesn't end well for David, and then Goliath ends up winning, and that's obviously frustrating, but it keeps people coming back. It's exciting. And, you know, getting back to this Warriors team, I mean, I can't think of too often through history where you have two MVP caliber players on the same team at the same time. And you referenced, you know, that certain guys, you didn't put it exactly this way, but get a little bit overrated perhaps because of the fact that they're on a championship team and the spotlight is shown on them. Where, you know, I think that Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love and Draymond Green and Klay Thompson are all, you know, really, really good players and some of the best players in the league, but, you know, they have, in my view, an inordinate amount of focus on them because, as they should, they're on a winning team and that team wins. But to me, you know, the three MVP caliber players in this series are Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, and LeBron James. So if you break it down just at that very basic level, you have two MVP caliber players versus one. And, you know, even thinking back in the day with the Celtics and their big three, the Heat's big three,
I mean, you got
Kobe and Shaq. Kobe and Shaq, yep.
Sure. And I would put Jordan and Pippen in that conversation as well. Those are the two I can think of off the top of my head where you had two arguably MVP caliber players dominant in their positions, in their primes at the same time together.
Right. So the Lakers, you got Worthy, Johnson, and Kareem, but Kareem is well past his prime, and Worthy was never quite at that MVP caliber level. So a great all-time team, but you didn't have, you know, the two guys. And I agree. I mean, Pippen, I think that's you could make that argument. Shaq and Kobe to me, that's the, I mean, that's really the only one that I can slam dunk, because those guys are just like, completely different in terms of being of his players, but are just like Kevin Durant and Steph Curry in that they're unstoppable. You cannot do anything to slow down Shaquille O'Neal or Kobe Bryant. And it's the exact same thing with LeBron. It's the exact same thing with Steph and also KD. I mean, those guys are completely unstoppable when they're going.
Yeah, that's what I talked about, going back to what I was saying, where guys saying, you know, certain former players saying, teams just need to play harder. It doesn't matter how hard you play against LeBron, Steph Curry, or Kevin Durant, they're going to do their damage. They're going to get their shots off. It's just because of who they are as players.
So looking out, you know, as we wrap things up here, looking out at this series moving forward, you know, as we've talked about a lot on the show, role players generally do better at home. So we would expect that the Cleveland bench was going to play better. One of my big selling points for why I convinced myself that Cleveland, you know, could win this series, and they still could. But obviously they have to win, in my view, the next two games, or they're going to lose in five. One of the big reasons they could win this series is I saw them as a more cohesive unit, and I thought that perhaps there was a chance that the Warriors having all those guys who wanted and needed the ball might create some friction in environments where you're facing adversity. And of course, that has not been the case at all so far in this series. And that the Cavaliers' role players, I thought, were also better than Golden State's role players, you know, Tristan Thompson, Kyle Korver, and that everyone had talked about how much the Warriors had upgraded themselves. But in my view, the Cleveland Cavaliers had upgraded themselves in a big way as well. Deron Williams, Kyle Korver, Tristan Thompson playing better, Kevin Love playing better. But so far, I mean, that has not been the case. We'll see if those guys step up on the home court. That's the big key, is the role players for Cleveland.
If it's me, I'm putting Kevin Love, Kyle Korver, J.R. Smith. You know, you can have Kyrie out there too, but I'm spotting all those guys up on the perimeter.
Yeah.
And I'm giving LeBron the ball right at half court, and I'm having Tristan Thompson come set a flat screen and just letting LeBron put his head down and go to the paint. Tristan Thompson rolling. And if anybody helps, I'm hitting one of those shooters. And they're all great shooters. You shoot threes. And if they rotate, I'm swinging it till I get an open look. And I'm just attacking that way. And maybe using some ISO stuff with Kyrie. It just simplify the game. Because LeBron, I mean, he was I thought he was amazing in game two.
Mm-hmm.
And just, once he gets a head of steam going to the hoop, it was like literally nothing anybody could do about it. And they weren't really helping off those shooters, and he kept getting layups. If I was trying to do, you know, get easy hoops on offense, I would stick with that. I mean, what are you going to do, help off Kyle Korver, right, Kevin Love, or Channing Frye? These guys are all 40-plus percent three-point shooters. And then you got one of the best penetrators to get to the hoop in the game, and LeBron, not to mention an unbelievable passer who's going to find those guys whenever the Warriors help. How do you guard that? That's my question. How would you guard that? You can't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I talked about it. I thought the Cavs played, like you said, played hard, played pretty good defense in game two, and they still gave up 130-plus mm-hmm. points. So maybe you can play a little bit smarter, get them down to the teens, and then you're going to have to outscore them.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to figure out how you're going to do that.
You got to outscore them with a three. That's the only way you're going to outscore them. And I think you're 100% right. I mean, that's the strategy I would use too. I'd either put Korver in the starting lineup or stay with what you have and see who's shooting it well during the game, and then stick with them throughout the course of the game. But I want to have those guys on the court.
And I think you can flow the game, the pace of the game, that way too. You know, if you pull it out, give it to LeBron, let him back it out, get a running start downhill towards the hoop. You can use some shot clock, let him rest a little bit. Once it gets down to 10, 11 seconds, boom, you go, and let LeBron make a play. I'd like to see more of that out of the Cavs, I think, to be more efficient on offense and help dictate the pace. You know, just going helter-skelter up and down against the Warriors, I don't think is the solution.
All right, so we'll talk again, and we'll see if the NBA Finals is still going on at that point. It's The Life of Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. Matt, as always, appreciate you joining us for the show.
All right, thanks for having me.